Lots of ins and lots of outs. From Fox News Radio, I'm Dana Perino.
Oh, and I'm Chris Starwalt.
And this is Perino and Starwalt. I'll tell you what. I didn't have a different intro, so I like that. Lots of ins and lots of outs.
Have you ever seen The Big Lebowski?
Oh, gosh, years ago.
What do you mean?
Like
when was the last time you watched it?
Well, I only watched it once. I don't repeat watch movies.
Really?
Except for Love Actually, I've seen like four times.
Oh, my gosh. I just became physically sick.
You're one of those.
Well, some movies, sure. Like, if The Big Lebowski's on, I will always watch it. I will also watch it sometimes just because it's very excellent. The Coen brothers' finest work and a great, great movie. But also others like The Untouchables. The house could be on fire. I will stay and I will watch The Untouchables. Sean Connery's performance in that is masterful. There are movies that just are always, they're just Dumb and Dumber, always good.
Yeah, I like that. Well, you know, but again, I don't watch them twice.
You don't watch anything twice other than the worst movie ever. But
I think that's such a waste of time. There's so many things to watch and learn and read. Like, I don't read books over again.
I read books over again.
I don't. I used to when I was a kid. I read A Wrinkle in Time about 80 times, probably.
Isn't that a great book?
One of the best.
I just finished every year at about this time, I read Steinbeck's Winter of Our Discontent.
Every year?
Yeah, just about every Eastertide, every Lenten season. It's quick, it's great, and Steinbeck's so good.
So good.
And Ethan Allen Hawley, and the story of a human struggling with right and wrong, and can versus should, and heritage versus the future. It's such a well-turned book, and it's seasonally set just right. His language about...
Right up there with The Big Lebowski.
Well, The Big Lebowski, hey, that's a really good movie. But the reason I mentioned it was that when The Big Lebowski holds Jeff Bridges' Lebowski to account for not making progress on the case of the kidnapped trophy wife, he goes, it's really complicated, man. There's a lot of ins, a lot of outs, a lot of what have you. So you had a very Lebowskiite opening because it left a lot of room for interpretation.
Well, we certainly have ins and outs.
Woof.
I just heard from a friend who last year was fighting on the side of support for the Export-Import Bank. Do you remember that fight? Okay, and so I just got a text from him saying, I just keep winning. Because we just found out that President Trump has changed his mind on another policy issue, and that is that whereas he railed against the Export-Import Bank during the campaign, he has now decided he will support it.
He says it's actually a good thing. It actually helps companies like Boeing and big manufacturers and others. He likes the Export-Import Bank for the same reason President Obama liked the Export-Import Bank, because if you're trying to increase U.S. exports, a little corporate welfare for U.S. manufacturers is maybe not so bad, you all of a sudden think, because it aligns with your goals. And the same is true. The president said that when he was running for office, I will declare China a currency manipulator on day one.
Mm-hmm.
Day one. And now on day 80 or whatever, he says, actually, China is not manipulating its currency. And in fact, if anything, the dollar is too strong.
So this gets into, I guess, a little bit of the palace intrigue that the president complains about in terms of anonymous sources in the press talking about what's going on within the White House.
As if
they even know what's going on in the White House. But this week, yesterday, we had President Trump give an interview to Michael Goodwin, a columnist at The New York Post, in which he said about Steve Bannon, the president's chief strategist, well, I like Steve, but.
I like Steve, but.
And it doesn't really matter what happens after but.
Right. But what he said is, number one, he wants to make the point. Everybody says he is the Iago, the Svengali, the, Cheney, behind the scenes, pulling
Oy.
The strings.
Ow.
Well, no, but that was what was said.
It was
Cheney,
true.
Right?
No, that's what was said about Carl.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, first he was Bush's brain. And then it was like, but wait, there's an even more sinister thing here. And it's really Richard B. Cheney, the Darth Vader. That was the role into which Manafort had been cast. Because if you are a reporter who wants to believe that Donald Trump is profoundly stupid and a buffoon, But then how is he also doing things and winning elections? And the answer must be that there is an evil manipulator, an Iago behind him who is telling him to do these things. And Bannon, whose website, Breitbart News, had been a home for white nationalism and a forum that elevated, if you could elevate the discussion about white nationalists. And so he fit perfectly, this vision. And Trump says, first, he didn't do that much in the campaign. He said, I'm my own strategist. Bannon was a Johnny-come-lately. So that's the first thing. This is not Iago, unless you're talking about the parrot that was with Jafar in Aladdin. And the other one is, he says, and makes no bones about it, that, you know, he's going to either straighten this out, and he's referring there to the heinous, heinous feud between Bannon and Trump's son-in-law, who Trump gave a job in the administration, Jared Kushner, all the jobs. Which jobs? All of them. And so it was reported that he had called him a very nasty name behind his back, and had said he's a, and then had pointed out that he's a Democrat, which
and he's a globalist
and a global elite.
Global elite making a comeback.
All of that, and yeah, the global elites are definitely making a comeback in the Trump administration.
They're so tired of winning.
But look, I wrote my halftime report today before the China currency manipulator, before the XM Bank, before all that other stuff. And my point was already based on the airstrikes in Syria and other events. Trumpism, as described by Steve Bannon and people like Stephen Miller, one of his acolytes inside the administration, is America first. I won't call it isolationism because that's not fair, but it's definitely anti-interventionist. And it called for a new world order in which a self-interested United States teamed up with a self-interested Russia and rebalanced the world against China to get China under control, to make China pay for its job-stealing ways, for all of this stuff. We are less than 3 months into the administration, and the president is doing business like crazy with China. China's helping him on North Korea. He's helping China on currency manipulation. China is watching as Trump blows up his relationship with Vladimir Putin and Russia. Watching all this happen, I think that the mistake for Bannon and the other America First, or however you want to describe these folks, was that they felt that they could do what no one has ever been able to do, which is to make Trump accountable for his previous positions. I watched Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, John Kasich. I watched a litany of Republicans, Ted Cruz eventually, at a point of desperation, try to make Trump accountable for what he had said before. You were you defended partial birth abortion. Now you say you're pro-life. Which is it? Those are the things that usually kill politicians. Trump doesn't care. He is not bound on Wednesday by what he said on Monday. I said this on Monday. I changed my mind. Why did I change my mind? Because the situation changed and I don't care. And for Bannon to think that he could make Trump eat America firstism when America firstism was not going to be popular, I think that was a bad misreading of the situation.
So, but isn't, I guess America first as described in Bannon's head,
right,
is turning out to be unpopular.
The
because realism overtakes populism as soon as you have bombs being sent.
Well, right. And so you have the vision of Trumpism cast in his speech at the Republican National Convention, and then the one in the most unusual, that's not how George W. Bush described it, but most unusual Trump inaugural address, this dark vision of the world, America dangling at the precipice, the light is almost out, we are here as these, basically, it's over. The only thing that can save us now is radical disruption. That, do you remember one of Trump's pitches when he was talking to black voters? You have nothing
left to lose.
You have nothing left to lose. And basically his inaugural address, as written by Bannon, was, dear America, you have nothing left to lose. We're going to destroy the administrative state. We're going to rip everything apart. We're going to do all this stuff. Now, as he approaches the three-month mark, Trump, I think, looks around and says, so you're saying that if I do things well, and am successful, people will like it. And I think those who thought that they could hold Trump to care, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, they thought that they could force Trump to stay in character. Trump adopted the character of angry populist in the Republican primaries and through much of the general. And they thought, well, he's switcherooed before in his career. He's taken different positions and opinions. He's done different things, but he has to eat this one because otherwise we'll abandon him and he'll be dead. I think what Bannon and others misapprehended was how willing the Republican establishment, the Washington establishment in both parties, would be to accept Trump. I think
that, well, but he's coming over to their point of view.
Exactly.
Right? So they're like, there was a great column the other day that I read that the establishment is the one that was responsible for Gorsuch.
Yeah.
Partly because, you know, he had worked in the administration,
right,
and he had been a part of the Federalist Society. And so,
right,
like, all of the elitism that was so ridiculed, and not for terrible reasons. I mean, I get that. But that there are reasons for people who are more mainstream Republicans to say, well, I can agree with that.
Sure.
All makes sense to me.
Right. And there are also reasons why, I forget what it is, you know, 60% of people approve the airstrikes on Syria because Trump figured out what the popular answer was. The popular answer was bomb them, but then come out immediately thereafter and say, but we are not invading. We are not putting boots on the ground. We are not getting involved on the ground in this civil war. This was a proportional response for a war crime that this guy committed. We did it in real time. We'll do it again if we have to, but we're not invading. He cut the Gordian knot. This is the popular position. People want the United States to take action against bad people, but they don't want to see the United States become embroiled in long-lasting overseas conflicts that result in a lot of dead Americans. So Trump said, I'll put it this way. Donald Trump is putting the popular back in populism.
Let me ask you this, though. Were you surprised that we're only, 84 days into the administration and that changes happened that quickly? And I'm not saying they're fixed or whatever.
No.
And that everything's
sailing
and is right, exactly. I guess my point is he'll change again.
And this is circumstances dictate.
He's not an ideologue.
At all. And he takes advantage of the fact that he's not an ideologue.
However, so do others. So, for example, when Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, is sitting next to the foreign minister of Russia,
Sergei Lavrov.
And Lavrov is basically saying, look, it's been really hard to figure out what this new White House means because they say one thing and then they say another and it's contradictory and it's unclear. And it's not our fault that we can't follow what the White House is saying.
Oh, well, boo-hoo.
Yeah, I know. Well, of course, that's I thought. I liked how Rex Tillerson was so cool next to Lavrov's hot.
Tillerson may make it. He had a very unfortunate start to his tenure.
He shouldn't have ditched his press pool, though.
That was super lame.
Why would you ditch a press pool in Russia when Russia basically wants to diminish the press corps?
Right.
Or kill them,
right,
really.
Exactly. The kiss or kill, they will either embrace you if you're a puppet. The Russian way is we embrace puppets. If you will tout the Kremlin line, we will laud you and give you access and give you all these things. If you buck us, we will freeze you out. And then if you buck us further, we'll kill you. And you remember Donald Trump, when confronted with that fact about Putin killing journalists, he said, oh, we're not so, I forget what he said.
He said, you think that we haven't done bad things too?
Yeah, you think we don't do
bad
things?
We're not so innocent.
Yeah, we're not so innocent. But that sort of moral equivocation doesn't work when you get down to the moment where you say, actually, I can have the whole country behind me if I stand up to Russia. Actually, I can have the whole country behind me when I stand up for press freedom. So the truth of the matter is most voters don't care whether Trump, most voters, I think, would agree with Donald Trump. As long as it's a win, as long as the right things happen, who cares?
So then it is also interesting, I think, how quickly foreign policy eclipsed domestic policy.
Well, yeah.
Because nobody's talking about the failed Health Care Act attempt by Republicans just a couple of weeks ago. Well, maybe they are back in their districts. But the news media isn't. And I guess that's still sort of on life support. Tax reform is another year off. Maybe they'll try to throw a little infrastructure in there to try to get Democrats to do that. But in the meantime, you have these special elections, one that was held yesterday in Kansas, the next coming up next Tuesday in Georgia,
yeah,
where Democrats, I guess they don't expect themselves, they don't expect to win, but they are certainly within striking distance.
I don't know. I don't know about that.
You think they might win in Georgia?
I think they could. Well, I'll tell you what. If the 20 point, so in the two special elections for House seats that have been held so far this year, the Democratic candidate has outperformed the Democratic 2016 nominee in that district by 20 points.
Yeah.
If they do that again, they'll win.
Right, but they're not doing that.
Look, I think, I don't know how to pronounce his name, whether it's Ossoff or Ossoff. I want to say Ossoff, but that's just me. But the Democratic candidate.
It's Ossoff.
Ossoff. The Democratic candidate in Georgia basically, and this is Tuesday, because they have a runoff system that if nobody gets over 50%, the top Republican and the top Democrat face each other in June. I believe it's June, May or June. If Ossoff doesn't get over 50%, so if somebody gets over 50%, he wins outright. Ossoff's best chance, and maybe only chance, is win with 51%, high Democratic intensity, get it out, exceed the performance. Remember, the difference between these districts. Kansas 4, which is centered around Wichita, is Donald Trump only underperformed Mitt Romney by a point. This is a red district in a red state. This is a seat that's been, I looked it up. I think it was, has only been represented by a not, this is like Alf Landon country. This is a district that's only been represented by a non-Republican like three times, four times. That's a district where Trump wasn't the factor. The factor out there was in, yes, it's part of diminished Republican intensity. But the big factor is that the Republican candidate, Ron Estes, is the state treasurer, and he's part of a direly unpopular Republican administration in Topeka. Sam Brownback is one of the least popular governors in the country. There are a lot of local issues at play here, but definitely at play, and the same thing we saw in the California primary to replace Javier Becerra, Democratic intensity is through the roof. Democrats are motivated. They're mobilizing. And if they mobilize in Georgia and they win that seat, which, again, I don't think is the most likely outcome, but it's enough that there will end up being probably $10 million spent, or no, probably more like $15 million spent on one cockamamie special House race in suburban Atlanta, because Democratic intensity is high enough that Republicans are sincerely worried. And if they were to lose, again, not the most likely outcome, but if that were to come to pass, it would be a catastrophe.
Interesting. But who knows what's going to happen?
Well, but that's why we watch.
That's why we have a podcast every Wednesday.
That's right, not Tuesday. We have it the day after the election.
You have any thoughts on North Korea or
glad not? I don't live there?
Yeah. Well, I feel bad for the people who do.
My God.
Under them. You know, because it's interesting about economic sanctions, because with Iran, in some ways it can kind of have an effect, because the Iranians still care enough about their people to not let them
and
starve.
And it's a democracy.
But in North Korea, he doesn't care.
He doesn't care. And plus the people are brainwashed and starving. It has been reported that the Chinese are preparing to or are moving troops to the border, what is that, the Yalu
mm-hmm.
River,
mm-hmm.
With North Korea. They're not there to invade. They're there because there are 20 million people in North Korea, if they are there. They're there because there are 20 million people in North Korea. The moment that somebody takes out Kim Jong-un, that is not a national security question. That is a human tragedy. That is a humanitarian issue. And the people in South Korea don't want 20 million starving North Koreans flooding south. The Chinese don't want them coming in with all their problems and diseases and starvation. This is a total disaster basket case. And what do you do about deprogramming these people who have been in camps and all of these things? So there has to be, you know.
I just sort of feel like, well, I know we can't, but like, should we all just leave them there?
Well, I mean,
we know they're being brainwashed and starved to death and made to do horrible things, and they're basically slaves to the state.
Right.
And everyone's like, well, I just don't want that problem.
Well,
I don't love that.
Yes. However, madam.
America first.
No. So we preserve the concept of the Treaty of Westphalia, nation state, that the state is responsible for what goes on in it. We remember after when George W. Bush said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. His message was, under that Westphalian concept of your country is responsible for what comes out of it. Your country is responsible for what it does. Whether you're democratically elected, whether you're undemocratically elected, whatever you are, whatever the government is of your state, we deal with each other government to government, not people to people. We respect the borders and we respect the integrity. There are a lot of bad places to live in the world. And I mean really bad places to live in the world. There are places where there is no hope. There are places where you look at what's going on in Venezuela right now. You look at a state failing. You look at despair coming. You look at oppression in the offing. It's coming down, and you can see the black veil slipping down over these people, and that is a tragedy. But we have to, or have traditionally acknowledged, we have to respect the nationhood of other nations, because otherwise, then no one is accountable for anything, and chaos reigns.
Right.
Sorry.
Well, I agree, but I don't like thinking about
it. It's a horrible feeling. And when you talk to smart people, basically it sounds like the best, if you were going to do it, if you were going to take out Kim Jong-un, what you would do in order to help China, help South Korea, and help the world is that you would essentially reunify Korea, make it one nation, and have this would be like a speed dating version of German reunification. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, and say, we're doing it. And then the first step is that North Korea becomes essentially a UN humanitarian relief camp,
right,
with everybody trying to feed these people and help them and see what they can do, or otherwise you have a serious crisis.
It's interesting because President Trump, in the press conference that with NATO, it was one of the first times that he ever admitted that he had changed his position.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the campaign, or maybe even after the election, he had said that NATO is obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And today he said, I used to say that. I do not believe that.
Yeah.
NATO is not obsolete. That's kind of that's interesting.
And
it's a different way of for him to approach one of these things.
Right. And again, when you hear, it is important in life to receive information from a variety of sources. It is important to have resources and knowledge from a broad spectrum. You cannot live on beef jerky alone. You have to have a balanced diet, and that comes with information too. And I think that in Trump's case, as it relates to NATO, he knew why people like Steve Bannon said NATO stinks. He knew why. Well, can I just make one aside?
Mm-hmm.
Think about how badly the Russians failed with their gambit right now, how badly it looks like the Russians failed with their gambit on the U.S. 2016 election.
I know.
They said, great, we're going to have Hillary Clinton, and she will be in weakened condition, or we get Trump, who is idiot and we control. He will be vassal. We have him. Ha, ha, ha. And then...
And the Soviet Union will be great again.
And we will... Exactly. We will make Vladimir Putin's DACA great again. And instead, and this is so funny, they were only too successful. Trump wins. Then they get found out for having done it. Now we find out that the FBI was monitoring Carter Page, the erstwhile, I'd say probably overestimated his role as Trump advisor. Paul Manafort says, in fact, I am going to register as a foreign agent lobbying for a foreign country on behalf of the former Putinist government in Ukraine, and on and on and on. So all of this comes out, and it leaves Trump in a position where, from domestic consumption, he can't be friendly with Russia. He can't be friendly with Russia, especially when they're propping up guys who gas children. So I find so funny for Russia, and I don't mean ha-ha, but they thought that they had probably pulled off this great coup with the 2016 election. They hack these emails. They feed them out through these anti-American outlets. They keep it going. And then in the end, they end up with the Russia hardliner anyway.
Indeed. But do you want some of your questions?
Oh, mailbag.
From the mailbag?
Woo!
We'll leave a little time for that because we've got some good ones.
Okay.
Well, this is an easy one. This is funny, not politics. Do you know of a food that shouldn't be fried? That's from Paul Dykstra. Do you know of any food that should not be fried?
Should not be fried. Well, I was going to say ice cream, but then I remembered Mexican fried ice cream.
So good.
I actually
love that.
But they don't
It is on my list of banned foods, but I might make an exception on like a birthday.
I bet that is a forbidden food. And I remember with the Chi Chi's restaurant, which we thought was...
Oh, I love Chi Chi's. They got good salsa.
Yeah, huh, that we thought was the pinnacle of Mexican food or exotic food when it opened
big
up
in margaritas.
Yeah, exactly. We thought when growing up, going up to Pittsburgh to Chi Chi's was like a thing. But the fried ice cream's not actually fried. They just fry bits of dough and roll the ice cream in it. Things that shouldn't be fried. I guess I would say this. Don't eat novelty foods. I don't like novelty foods. I like food, obviously.
How do you classify a novelty food?
We put blank in the blank. We made a sandwich out of waffles, and we put a whole wheel of cheese in it, and we blah, 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 blah. And it's like, or you go, just if it's stunt food, walk away. Make excellent food. Excellent food is excellent ingredients. It is usually prepared quite simply. It is good that way. I don't like joke food. I don't like ridiculous food. I mean, I'll eat anything. Let's be clear. I'll eat the hind end out of a rag doll. I don't care because I am a fat
American.
That
is disgusting.
What? It's a doll.
Oh, my God.
Oh, they didn't have that in Wyoming?
I've never heard that phrase.
Well, they didn't say hind.
In my life.
They didn't say hind where I came from, but I think you get the meaning.
Wow.
But the idea of the ridiculous stuff, I don't go for. Keep it simple. Don't fry it. If it doesn't want to be fried, don't fry it.
I did have people wanting an update on your experiment with the protein bar that I suggested, the Epic Bar.
Yeah.
All meat, bacon.
And
you ruined it for me. I have had one in my bag for 3 days and not opened it because of something you said.
Because I said it tasted like dog food?
Yeah.
But I didn't mean that in the pejorative way that you did or that you took it. I would say this. The Epic Meat Bar, which of course
meat bar.
Yeah, the Epic Meat Bar, which sounds like basically the name for my another name for my all male dance review.
oh my God.
But that the Epic Meat Bar, because it is not overly processed and that doesn't have any sugar or anything in it, it is dried ground meat in stick form. So there is that canine chow quality to it. But I have, to prove my previous statement, I have eaten five of them.
I might try it again tonight.
I had it today. You just have to remember, some dog food's better than others. There's a story from back home where the people had a fancy gardener from Italy, and because they had a beautiful estate and they had done all this stuff, and he came in to eat lunch with the help.
Oh, no.
And they were having corned beef hash that day, and he got up and left and quit. And as they were chasing him down the driveway to try to get him to stay, he said, I'm not going to stay anywhere where they feed me dog food. And then people say,
well, I know what they mean. I mean, we used to feed my dog Jocko would get that kind of food out of the way. And like that was kind of like the worst chore you could
get. The worst chore, opening that can.
It was hard because also you had to be really careful so you didn't cut your finger on it. But you also didn't want to touch the inside of the can.
The disgusting and the odor that wafted off. That experience of feeding Susie the Wonder Dog when there was a canned food phase, the sound of that. Automatic can, electric can opener.
Oh,
stopping.
Oh, you were fancy. We didn't have it automatic.
Stopping, and you hear the click, and you know that you're going to have to dump that into the bowl. That was tough.
And mix it around with the fork.
Wow.
Dog food is a lot better now.
Well, I'm sure for Jasper, who probably has pâté de foie gras served with cornichon.
No, he doesn't, but he has like a fresh pet thing. But when Peter presents it to him, he does some sort of fancy, hilarious thing. Okay, here's another question from Travis Bocello.
Okay,
what
Travis.
Is the most memorable political event that you have covered over the years?
Donald Trump's election.
Okay, that was an easy one.
I mean, whoa.
Whoa.
Yep.
And what about like back in your days in West Virginia, like at the paper?
Oh, Lordy day. There was a lot of stuff what got did. The decision of a governor not to seek re-election because of some things that he was doing that he shouldn't have been doing.
A la Alabama?
a la Alabama.
Get it? A la Alabama,
which is in Northwest Alabama. West Virginia politics is so great. And one of the things that I love about West Virginia politics is basically this. And I would really say this for every young person in America. I believed when I came from my hometown to the capital city of Charleston, I believed when I had my dream job and was the political editor for the Charleston Daily Mail, I believed that I was in the big leagues. Like, boy, I've been back hayseed from Nowheresville. Now I'm in the big city and all that stuff. And I thought these people must be better. It must be at a higher level. And you know what I found out? They weren't. The people there in the bigger city and the capital city weren't that much better. Then when I came to Washington, I thought, man, holy crokino, I'm here in Washington. These people are the best. You know what? The quality of the work, the quality of the people, the intellects, the all the stuff, really isn't that different when you get from a bigger level to bigger level. So from smaller level to a bigger level. So don't be afraid to take the shot at the show, because if you can make, I promise you this, if you can cover politics in West Virginia, you can cover it anywhere.
Well, can we talk a little bit about your friend? I wanted you to tell me about the reporter, your friend from West Virginia, that just won the Pulitzer Prize for his.
Eric Ayer.
Yes.
He won a great – the Pulitzers this year did a great job because they really – there was not a lot of overt political bias in how they picked their awards. They really gave shout-out to community and smaller newspapers, which really keep the country together in a lot of ways. And Eric did – and this is the other thing. A two-part series – this is a note to people who are coming up with series. It doesn't need to be 11 parts. He had a two-part series reporting on more than 700 million pills, opioid drug pills, that were dumped into West Virginia by wholesalers and drug companies and whomever. This is a state with, as I wrote, about as many people as Metro Nashville in all of West Virginia, 1.85 million people in West Virginia, more than 700 million pain pills dumped in over a very short, I forget how many years, but a short number of years. And he just went through and he found the records and he went back through and he talked about it and raised the unanswerable question, or not the unanswerable question, the most important question, which is, at what point did somebody at a drug wholesaler, at a drug maker, at the state medical board, at what point did somebody say, boys, something is wrong here, and I need to voice my concern. I need to say something here. But nobody did, and the drugs kept flowing, and we have seen the consequences.
Well, I'm excited about that. It was interesting, as you and I were texting earlier about the earlier this week when that came out. One of the great things about the internet and news consumption, especially if you love news and are a curious person, I actually read that piece when it came out because it got some attention. I guess I saw it on Twitter or something, and I put it in my weekend reading folder and read it. But, you know, 20 years ago or 15 years ago even, I never would have seen it it won the Pulitzer.
Right, until it won the Pulitzer and until the New York Times ripped it off.
Oh, yeah, true. That does happen.
That does happen.
So what's next for him? Well, a guy like Eric, will he stay in West Virginia?
Eric has been in West Virginia. I haven't talked to him in years, but Eric, I know, will be right there in Charleston, WVA. He is not, you know, in a lot of small market journalism, the goal is get young talent cheap, work them hard for a couple few years, and then they're going to move on. They're going to move on.
Right.
And you see very few guys like Eric, who, I don't know exactly how old Eric is, but he's older than me, that he stayed and that he's there and he does these stories. And the Poynter Institute did an interview with him about what it is. He still does once a month, he takes a turn on the Night Cops beat just to stay fresh, just to stay sharp, just to stay in it, to go down and hear what's going on and who's getting arrested and who got and all that stuff. I think it's really cool.
I'm a big fan of living in local in smaller communities. And we should talk about that next week.
OK.
Because it's something for people think about graduation and where they're going to go. A lot of people gravitate to cities, but there's some great opportunities in sort of mid-sized towns.
Oh, be a big fish. Be a big fish
Absolutely.
In a small pond. You'll have more opportunities to do more things. Don't say, I'm going to go get – I mean, for me, the best thing that happened to me was that I couldn't find a place in the big city. I couldn't find a job in the big city, and I had to go back to West Virginia, and I had to make it work there. And I learned, and I had the chance to do so many things that I wouldn't have had if I was 75th in line for the apprenticeship – deputy intern.
I agree. Here's another question from Joe Michalski.
Okay.
When are we going to start building the wall, fixing healthcare, and creating jobs? Can't create jobs without a healthcare plan. And President Trump basically said in his interview yesterday that he's got to get the healthcare thing done so that he can move on to tax reform, which then he believes will help create an environment for more job growth.
I figure that what they're going to do is come up with some cockamamie thing that can pass the House. Something. It may just be you open it up and inside is just a gif of a unicorn. I don't know. But find some way that you can pass something out of the House and dump it in the Senate's lap and then blame Democrats or something. They want to win. They want to say they did something. I also think that the unending pressure game, the horrible pressure. The White House, as you know, is already pressure enough. Working in the White House, the eyes of the world upon you, all of that stuff. Then when you work at a White House where the boss is the Mr. You're Fired and who dangles people over the pit of despair on a weekly basis. I like you. I don't like you. You may be out. You may be in. I like him. All that stuff with all of the, you know, and then who will Omarosa betray next week? All of that stuff going on. You got to then, so let's say you're Reince Priebus. You're friends with Paul Ryan. You are the former squad leader of the Republican establishment. And you have failed at healthcare. You tried it. You're failing. And you would become desperate for a win, right? You think Trump wants wins. If you're Priebus, oh my gosh, you need wins. You want wins. Because again, you have this mercurial boss who changes around all the time. And so the question for Republicans is, do they want to fix it? If they want to fix healthcare in the country, it's going to be politically unpopular for some period of time. It's going to take weeks and months. It's going to be hard. It's going to do this thing. Or do they want to say, the House passed something and it's in conference and in the end, and which way do they want to do it?
It's interesting because then you also have the hearings that will take place. The last question was, when will Susan Rice be called to testify? She won't be the only one that gets called to testify. It's interesting to see the tribalism and the team sport nature of this Russia investigation. Like, I actually don't have a dog in the fight. I just want to know what happened. I would like for this investigation to be completed because I think there's a lot of other important things we need to work on, including safeguarding our elections for the next time. But when do you think she might get called to testify? They want to know.
Well, it is reasonable and proper to be concerned both about allegations of Trump staffers colluding with Russia and inappropriate contact with Russia, and to be concerned about profligacy in leaking in the Obama administration. It is acceptable to have both things concern you. It is not, does not need to be an either or. It doesn't need to be, I'm worried, this is the real Watergate, this is the real scandal, forget about that. It is possible for a sentient, patriotic person to say, both of these things are concerning, and there is evidence to suggest that both may be true. So let's let the investigation work its way through. When will Susan Rice be called to testify? It depends on whether it's the Senate or the House. I have a feeling that Devin Nunes, regardless of the new comity that we have seen, in the outburst of comity with Adam Schiff, his Democratic counterpart, I think that they're going to be becalmed. I think the Senate's going to be where the action is. And Mark Warner is making it pretty clear he plans to move expeditiously.
Very interesting. Well, I think they should move expeditiously. We've got a lot of other things we've got to
exactly.
work on.
Exactly.
Plus, there's this other stuff, which is basically they need to have a hearing about war powers.
Oh, fiddly-dee.
I mean, I believe that the president has the powers, but I respect the fact that there should be a debate.
Well, now, wait a minute. There's
no
debate.
I think this last one was a little shaky.
Which one?
A little shaky.
The Syria airstrikes?
The Syrian airstrikes.
Oh, fiddle.
Don't?
No. He did one, I won't say mostly symbolic. He knocked it. But it was a proportional. You don't need congressional authorization. When a dictator uses, we have all of the rules about no gas. You cannot gas people in war. You cannot use chemical weapons. That has been the battlefield regulation for
I know.
That's a hard line. So he did one, and now he's not doing anything else, right? It's not like there's going to be follow up.
Okay, well, I guess that one would assume that there must have to be some follow up. They could just let it keep going like the way it was going. I don't think so.
I think they will. I think they absolutely will. I think that they will. I think that you will continue to see the U.S. standing up Iraq. You will continue to see more U.S. forces on the south side of that conflict. You will see more U.S. intervention that way. But I highly doubt that you are going to see a U.S. commitment inside of Syria or anything that looks like direct regime change. I would imagine that this was a one-off. And I believe Rex Tillerson when he said, yeah, this is a bombing, but this does not reflect a change in U.S. policy. I bet he's right.
Okay. I'll go with that. Right. Do you want some trivia?
I am afraid.
Okay. I actually think that these are easier.
Okay.
All right.
When you say that, that's always
I know.
The worst.
I know. But I actually think it is because I was like,
I need a win worse than Rince Priebus.
Okay. Only two vice presidents have ever resigned from office. Can you name them?
Spiro T. Agnew. Mm-hmm. And who is the other vice president that would have resigned from office? Resigned. Why would you resign if you were vice president, other than that it's not a great job? Spiro Agnew and who? I don't know.
Calhoun.
John C.?
Yeah, he resigned to take a seat in the Senate.
Oh, okay. Well, that'll tell you something about the qualities of that job.
Yeah, why would you? That's what I was thinking.
Say, I'm out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, question two. Which president had an outdoor swimming pool installed at the White House?
FDR?
No.
Who?
Oh, I thought you would know that.
Who?
Gerald Ford. Big swimmer.
Big swimmer.
And he later added a cabana. Jason Bonewald included that in the parentheses.
You don't think of Jerry Ford as a cabana guy, but then you see that picture of him in Vail with the sunglasses on. You're like, maybe.
Yeah, I can see that. He's an athlete.
Yeah, maybe.
Copacabana.
I could see that.
Did
you? And you also saw that Barry. I enjoyed the news that Barry Manilow came out this week.
Yes, I did see that.
There were probably some ladies down at the Villages and around that were probably disappointed in that.
It was probably, I assumed that he was out.
Yeah. I think that the conventions on that have changed so much. Now, it used to be like, oh, can you believe?
And I was like,
are you
going
to? Now it's like,
even
okay.
You had the news this week about Caitlyn Jenner's surgery, and you're like, okay.
I managed to avoid that until just now. Thanks for
you didn't know
it for
about
me.
That?
Nope. Thanks
yeah,
for
the surgery has
me.
Taken place.
Hard pass.
No going back now.
Yep, there you go.
Okay. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com and subscribe to this one on iTunes or wherever you listen. And make sure to leave us a review. This has been Perino and Starwalt. I'll tell you what on Fox News Radio.